going to Africa, literally, and thousands upon thousands of people, I would be the only white person. I felt like I really stuck out, not only being a woman of size, but also being very white.
The face and the body of this character is an instrument to be someone, because he's used his body and his face to say something of himself.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A lesbian medic fights AIDS in Uganda, the Italian opposites interact in Adored, and the UN's unholy alliance scuttles Brazil's queer rights resolution. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And filling in for Cindy Friedman, I'm Kathy Sanchez.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending April 3rd, 2004. Brazil has asked for a postponement of its proposal that the United Nations protect the civil rights of sexual minorities, citing a lack of consensus on the UN Commission on Human Rights. Vehement opposition from the Vatican and the Islamic bloc had already stalled the motion at last year's commission session. The group Human Rights Watch claims it was the opponent's threats to boycott a summit meeting Brazil is hosting later this year for Arab and Latin American leaders, and even to break off trade relations, that forced the withdrawal. Brazil has yet to comment on that claim. Numerous non-governmental organizations from around the world signed the joint statement expressing disappointment at the further delay. 26 Western nations had supported Brazil's original introduction of the resolution, and activists are lobbying its 18 co-sponsors on the commission to bring it back to the table. Openly gay member of the European Parliament from the UK, Michael Cashman, labeled the united opposition of the Islamic bloc and the Vatican an unholy alliance. That same alliance is also currently attacking the UN's new policy of extending spousal benefits to those of its gay and lesbian employees whose partnerships are recognized in their home nations. This week, they won a resolution from an administrative and budgetary committee that the Secretary General reconsider the new policy. A spokesperson said that review will take place, but added that any revised policy will still be guided by the employees' national laws.
The U.S. has not been a supporter of lesbo-gay civil rights at the U.N., and its own lack of national protections from sexual orientation discrimination was highlighted in two ways this week. The Office of the Special Counsel is a small federal agency tasked with protecting U.S. civil servants from retaliation for their claims of discrimination or whistleblowing activities. Its new head, Scott Block, a Bush appointee, has removed from its materials all references to protections from sexual orientation discrimination. The administrations of five presidents over more than 20 years have protected equal treatment of gay and lesbian civilian employees. Yet Block has claimed that his reading of relevant laws does not protect those workers based on what he calls their status as gay or lesbian, only their conduct. A number of Democratic lawmakers held a press conference this week to protest Block's move and called on the president to take action to reverse it. White House spokesperson Trent Duffy told reporters, "The president believes that no federal employee should be subject to unlawful discrimination. That's longstanding federal policy that prevents discrimination based on sexual orientation." At the prodding of openly gay Democratic Congress member from Massachusetts, Barney Frank, as to what the president was actually going to do about his apparent difference with Block, Duffy added only that the federal agencies will fully enforce the laws prohibiting discrimination in the workplace. By its nature, the Office of Special Counsel is granted considerable independence, and grounds are very limited for removing its head before the expiration of his five-year term.
Block's language of status and conduct are more familiar from the U.S. military, although there, at least in theory, it's conduct that leads to discharge. Military discrimination against gays and lesbians has, in the past, led some colleges and universities to deny campus access to military recruiters, as they do by policy to other employers who discriminate. That particular form of protest was essentially quashed several years ago by the so-called Solomon Amendment, which denies federal funding to schools that bar military recruiters. This week, the U.S. House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly to bolster the Solomon Rule by explicitly requiring equal access for military recruiters and requiring schools to submit an annual report to that effect to the Secretary of Defense. Activists are lobbying to try to block the bill in the U.S. Senate.
Numerous U.S. state legislatures continue to wrestle with bills regarding recognition of gay and lesbian relationships. This week, Georgia lawmakers approved for the November elections ballot a proposed state constitutional amendment prohibiting same-gender marriages. The Georgia House okayed by just two votes more than the necessary minimum, the same measure that had fallen three votes short there in a February floor vote.
Massachusetts voters are a step closer to seeing a proposed constitutional amendment. Their state lawmakers this week gave the first of two required endorsements. The stakes are higher in Massachusetts since a ruling by the state's highest court requires the state to begin licensing same-gender marriages in mid-May. The procedure for amending the state constitution, the nation's oldest, is more cumbersome there as well, requiring that a second legislative session approve the same proposed amendment before it can appear on the general ballot. Moved by a sense that they had to advance something, and powerful arm-twisting by political leaders, including Republican Governor Mitt Romney, the Massachusetts legislators, sitting as a constitutional convention, agreed on what's been called a compromise but is highly distasteful to both sides.
On the one hand, the proposed amendment states that only the union of one man and one woman shall be valid or recognized as a marriage in the Commonwealth. But it goes on to state that two persons of the same sex shall have the right to form a civil union if they otherwise meet the requirements set forth by law for marriage. Civil unions for same-sex persons are established by this article and shall provide entirely the same benefits, protections, rights, privileges, and obligations that are afforded to persons married under the law of the Commonwealth. The proposal also recognizes that, under present federal law, same-sex persons in civil unions will be denied federal benefits available to married persons.
Since there's no way this measure can be enacted before late 2006, Romney wants the state Supreme Court to stay its earlier marriage ruling. Attorneys for the plaintiffs in the lawsuit that won the marriage ruling say the governor has no legal basis to request the stay. And the Democratic State Attorney General Thomas Riley has refused to file the request. However, Riley has also affirmed that a 1913 Massachusetts law will not allow non-residents to contract marriages their home states would not allow. He believes that will prohibit marriages for gays and lesbians from all but a dozen states. Although the group Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders believes a case could be made for a few more.
Rhode Island's legislature is considering bills both for and against same-gender marriages, and a rally in support of those marriages moved the state's House Majority Leader Gordon Fox to publicly identify himself as a gay man for the first time. Democrat Fox has been in a committed relationship for 6 years. He went on to refer to his personal situation again in testimony before a House committee.
Britain's government this week unveiled its civil partnership bill to create legally recognized same-gender relationships. While not entirely equivalent to marriage, civil partnership features financial responsibility for a partner and a couple's children, the option to become a legal parent for the partner's child, and recognition in areas including hospital visitation, immigration, inheritance, tenancy succession, life insurance, and Social Security and pension benefits. Deputy Minister for Women and Equality, Jackie Smith, said the bill underlines the inherent value of committed same-sex relationships and opens the way to respect, recognition, and justice for those who have been denied it for too long.
Britain's Foreign Office and its Queen aren't even waiting for enactment of the bill to recognize at least one gay male couple. Britain's new ambassador to Luxembourg, James Clark, had registered his partnership with Anthony Stewart under the Foreign Office's five-year-old plan extending benefits to unmarried partners. When Clark was given a formal audience with Queen Elizabeth at Buckingham Palace this week, Stewart was by his side as the first same-gender partner to be received by the Queen, just as heterosexual ambassador spouses are. Clark is Britain's first openly gay ambassador, and he and Stewart are the Foreign Office's first officially recognized gay couple to be sent abroad. They have already moved into the official residence in Luxembourg and will attend social functions there together.
The Canadian province of Quebec legally married its first same-gender couple this week, following a March ruling by the province's top court. Michael Hendricks and René Leboeuf, the couple of more than 30 years who were the plaintiffs in the long legal battle for equal marriage rights, married at the Montreal courthouse with rings, vows, some passionate kisses, and even a thrown bouquet. They chose April 1st for their wedding date because it marked the third anniversary of the world's first legal same-gender marriages in the Netherlands.
And finally, April 1st also marked the first anniversary of the death of Leslie Cheung, one of the first celebrities in the Chinese world to speak publicly about being a gay man. He's best known to the Western world for his performances in the films Farewell, My Concubine and Happy Together, but in Asia, his singing was at least as important as his acting. He committed suicide last year at the age of 46, a victim of depression. But he lives on in the hearts of his fans, who turned out in heavy rain by the thousands near his last residence in Hong Kong to leave flowers and sing his hits together. Most of the crowd came from China, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, Malaysia, and Singapore. One memorial event even sold out its 800 tickets in less than a month, China Daily reported. Hong Kong newspapers gave heavy coverage to the anniversary, while in one of them, some fans paid for a 6-page color supplement.
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 3rd, 2004, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Kathy Sanchez.
And I'm Rick Watts.
A fraternal reunion and some fateful revelations are at the heart of an Italian director's examination of opposites and morality. You'll learn more about him and the film The Festival Circuit Adored later in the program. The AIDS Healthcare Foundation has done pioneering work saving and changing lives in the U.S., but can such an organization translate its success to the situation in sub-Saharan Africa, where the magnitude of the crisis may be as much as 40 times greater? One lesbian activist, physician's assistant, believes it can be done. This Way Out correspondent Nancy Beverly takes us on an incredible journey with AIDS Healthcare Foundation co-founder Mary Adair.
Picture this.
Because of HIV in Uganda, the average age lifespan of an individual is 42 years old, and AIDS is the leading cause of death in Uganda. And one of the things that was so overwhelming for me is that when you would leave the main city of Kampala to go into Masaka, you would see on the sides of the road coffin makers, and they would lay out their coffins standing up on the side of the road for people to purchase because so many people were dying.
And picture this.
Unfortunately, 40 million people are infected in sub-Saharan Africa, and without treatment, those 40 million people will eventually die. So we're talking about major economic devastation in a continent of people.
By comparison, the U.S. has less than 1 million people with AIDS. The woman you just heard is Mary Adair. She works at the AIDS Healthcare Foundation in Los Angeles. In the year 2000, she and her fellow workers at the foundation took on the daunting challenge of trying to treat people in Africa who have AIDS. Mary is no stranger to a challenge. Back in 1987, when AIDS patients were dying in the hallways of County Hospital here and being rejected by their families, Mary co-founded the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, which began as a hospice. Once treatment became available, they began to provide it, and Mary became a physician's assistant there in 1994. The foundation's mission is to treat the underserved, and to that end, they have 15 sites in California where they treat HIV. The underserved are certainly not limited to California, and so 4 years ago, the foundation decided to go to Africa.
In the AIDS conference in 2000, the year of 2000, in Durban, South Africa, our CEO and president, Michael Weinstein, went to the AIDS conference there and was approached by some AIDS activists from South Africa. And they had heard about AIDS Healthcare Foundation and how we had grown from a very small organization to the largest nonprofit in the United States treating HIV. And they wanted to talk to us about how they could politically do some of the things that we have done in the United States to kind of build our organization.
So AIDS Healthcare Foundation decided to partner with non-governmental organizations in Africa, or NGOs.
They came and we got to meet them, and we were very inspired by their passion because it was very much how we felt in the early 80s, the sort of grassroots, how do we take care of our people? We're dying. We don't know what to do. The government's against us. Just all the things that we had experienced in the early 80s with the Reagan administration and homophobia and all that, except that in Africa, it's mostly a heterosexual disease. So it wasn't so much the homophobia, but it was more an issue of poverty and resource limitations. So after we met with these people that were part of NETCOM and another group called Uganda Business Coalition that was in Uganda, we decided that in order to bring treatment there or to have people recognize that treatment could be done there without the infrastructure, that we actually needed to go and do it. So what we did is we gave initial funding through our own organization to go there and to start up some pilot programs. So we had two pilot programs. One was in South Africa called the People's Hope Clinic, and the other one is called Uganda Cares in Uganda. And we started out initially with very few people, only 20 people in these initial pilot kind of studies that we had a criteria in order to recruit patients. We had to have a certain standard by which we could tell if this program was going to succeed or not. The need is so tremendous there that we were afraid we'd be hugely overburdened. And so we had to initially just say that we were going to provide treatment and pay for the treatment for 20 people in each site.
By now, it's February 2001. A new branch of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation called Global Immunity has been created. The criteria for the 20 people who are to receive treatment has been decided upon, and Mary is flying to Uganda to set up a clinic. This is how her first moments unfold.
Going to Africa, literally, in thousands upon thousands of people, I would be the only white person. And it was really interesting. I felt like I really stuck out, not only being a woman of size, but also being very white. And I remember the first event I went to was actually the funeral of the mayor's wife who had died of AIDS.
Which city?
In Masaka. And it was blazing hot. And my clothes had been lost in transit. So I had black wool clothes on, and that's all I had to go to this funeral in. It must have been, 102 in the shade. So I walk in, we're late, unfortunately, to outside the mayor's home in his beautiful banana garden. And they put up a tarp. And for some of the lucky people who got to sit under that in chairs, there's only maybe 200 people that got to sit on chairs under the tarp. But there were literally 2,000 people who were standing in the hot sun. The mayor's wife was in a casket that was covered with white lace, surrounded by her female relatives who were kind of wailing. And this is my first event in Africa, and I go in, and of course they see me and they ask somebody to stand up, and I get placed in a very special area, which, I mean, I didn't even know her name, and I'm like sitting in an honored space, and I'm feeling very out of place, and everybody's kind of looking at me, but I'm watching this go on, and it's in Lugandan, which is not English, and I had no clue what was going on. All of a sudden, I hear America, and I go, uh-oh. Next thing I know, I'm being, brought up stage or where the casket is, and I go up there, and they ask me to say something. Well, it was a very odd experience because I had just arrived, didn't know anybody, and didn't even know if I should say the word HIV. So basically, I just said that, I thanked them for having me here, and that we hoped that the Masaka Clinic would be able to serve a lot of people in the community. And all of a sudden, 2,000 people all at one time went, and I thought, wow, what does that mean? So anyway, I just kind of hand the microphone over, and I sit back down, and there was a woman who was showing me around with me, and I said, what did that mean? And she says, oh, that was showing you tremendous respect.
And that was just the beginning.
Indeed, it's just the start of AIDS Healthcare Foundation co-founder Mary Adair's remarkable saga of building a clinic in Uganda and how so many lives, including hers, were profoundly changed. Mary Adair's story, as told to Nancy Beverly, concludes next time on This Way Out.
Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through direct charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air and get some queer audio history and timeless music in the bargain, or for audio cassette subscription information, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. I'm just a love machine.
Gay film festivals in Europe and the U.S. fell in love with the Italian film a little more than a year ago. That was also its original English language title. Now, writer-director star Marco Filiberti's comedy drama is finally ready for its close-up as the first U.S. theatrical release by Wolf Video. It also has a new title, Adored, Diary of a Male Porn Star. In one of his few stateside interviews, Filiberti talks with This Way Out's Steve Pride about being a multitasking filmmaker, his lead character, and crossover appeal.
The first thing you notice about Marco Filiberti in person is that he's smaller and more reserved than the larger-than-life Ricky Kandinsky he plays in his film, Adored, Diary of a Male Porn Star. While a few critics have labeled this film as unrepentant melodrama, it's really a drama-comedy with moments of camp and lots and lots and lots of Marco Filiberti.
Hi, I'm Marco Filiberti. I'm the writing director and the first actor. The story is very complicated, the plot, but simply two brothers are reunited before 11 years after his father's death. And two worlds opposite collides because Federico the older is a perfect gentleman. He lives in a country castle, but he is very frustrated professionally and personally. And in other end, Riccardo is a boy free, authentic, a little bit amoral, and he's a gay porn star, Ricky Kandinsky. At begin, the two are good, also in a strong way, but then the desire to understand grow out, and his life changed very much after this reunion.
You're on screen almost constantly in this film, so what were the challenges of being the writer, director, and the star?
This film evolved from the personality of the character of Ricky Kandinsky. It was very, very hard at a physical point of view because it's not simply to be in front and behind the camera, yes. But for me, it was a requirement to make this character.
Marco, the subtitle of Adored is Diary of a Male Porn Star. So what I'm getting at is Marco Filiberti, the director, has to spend a lot of time focusing on the face and body of Marco Filiberti, the actor.
The eyes of Ricky Kandinsky, it's the same thing, think of the soul of Ricky Kandinsky. So it was very important to be close up to the face of Ricky, because the face and the body of this character is an instrument to be someone, to leave his mark in the life, because he's used his body and his face to say something of himself.
Marco, what are your influences? I mean, there are a number of gay films from Spain, France, and Germany, but I can't think of that many gay-themed films from Italy.
I think that I am more close to the Spanish way, because I think that this film is not a gay film, but I hope is a human film, like life, with comedies and drama together. In Italy, the gay cinema is very concentrate on gay life, gay story, and in this way it cannot open to great public. And I hope that my movie can represent this complicated way to try to stay together with the gay people and the straight people together.
Marco, you make out with a lot of guys in this film, but that could just be acting. And since metrosexuality has totally trashed my gaydar, I'm just going to ask, what is your personal sexuality?
I am a very free person, really. And in my life, I had a different experience. In this time, I am alone. So, but I haven't problem to say if I felt in love for a boy. I haven't problem to say because I think that it's very important for an artist to be authentic for himself and for his public. So when I come back to the US next time, I will be with a boy near to me. I will be happy to say.
Marco, is there a message that you want the audience to take away from the film?
I hope that people think that in all time of our life, we need to revisit everything, because everything changes. Also, we think to be very free, very authentic. Perhaps we are not so. It's very important to have open heart, open mind in every moment of his life. And also, of course, it's important to not stop of the appearance of people, but see inside. And also, I hope that everyone can find his desire just for one moment in his life.
This has been a conversation with Marco Filiberte, writer, director, and star of Adored, Diary of a Male Porn Star. The film marks the theatrical distribution debut of Wolf Video. More information can be found at www.adoredthemovie.com and prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
I'm just a love machine, and I won't work for nobody but you. I'm just a love machine. Hey, baby.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Rick Watts, Kathy Sanchez, Graham Underhill, Fenceberry, Rex Walkner, Nancy Beverly, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Paul Simon and Wham! Performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on planetout.com. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from Clarissa Pincola Estes, La Sociedad de Guadalupe Foundation, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. You too can help keep this program on the air and get some queer history and culture CDs as our gifts. For all the details, log on to thiswayout.org or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KFAR Knoxville, Tennessee, 6RTR Perth, West Australia, WCBN Ann Arbor, Michigan, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.